This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 230 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by CanvasPeople.com. CanvasPeople.com has a very easy-to-use photo-to-canvas service that takes your favorite photo memories and turns them into beautiful artwork for you to enjoy every day. Instead of snapping that beautiful photo and letting it rot in your cell phone, you can bring that photo to life and put it on your walls at home or in your office, or give as a great gift.
Summer and I both love our shots, and we can say that we are included among the over 1 million customers served. And you can buy with confidence because there are a lot of people who are extremely happy with their prints. And let us just explain how detailed this is. It is such high quality canvas. First of all, you can feel the canvas. It feels like a painting, like an actual canvas, because it is.
So normally an 11 by 14 canvas is priced at $69.99. But a limited time offer, you get one free 11 by 14 canvas. You just pay shipping.
So to get this special offer, just go to canvaspeople.com, upload your picture, select the 11 by 14 inch size, and enter promo code Outlander in the promo code box in the cart to get the special $0 price.
To get that special $0 price at canvaspeople.com. That's promo code Outlander in the promo code box in the cart.
That's canvaspeople.com, promo code Outlander.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing Chapter 2 of Drums of Autumn, entitled, In Which We Meet a Ghost.
Cindy R. writes, the ghost theme continues in this chapter, noticeably with the title, In Which We Meet a Ghost. Claire states she, quote, feels like a ghost, unquote, due to the encompassing dark giving her an out-of-body type experience. So the chapter opens and Fergus is counting out his earnings from that night's busking. Ish, not really busking, busking.
Yeah, that's true.
The table was
getting that confused for a moment with Ian gambling and getting the dog. So, and then I remembered, oh, no, he was right. He was passing the hat around.
So Claire has settled with the landlord for their meal and they are ready to go take care of the burial of Gavin Hayes. They want to get rid of the body that night. Otherwise, stink.
Well, stink and wild animals.
Well, yeah, then there's that. So because it's so late, though, they decide to bury Gavin themselves. And Fergus, Jamie's like, can you go over there and see how much a wee shovel spade would cost? And so Fergus purchases a shovel. So basically, even though they have, well, not I would say permission, they already have the price. They know how much it's going to cost for to have Gavin buried. And you know, I wondered, and Diana, unless I missed it, Diana did not address this in the chapter. So they were going to bury him legitimately, you know, legally, and pay for everything. But the priest had them over a barrel because it's like, we know you don't want to keep a body in this heat and you want to leave. So we're going to charge you all the schnuffalumpkins and like make you even poorer than you are because they barely had any money.
That is not a legitimate currency.
Schnuffalumpkins?
Yep, that. I'm going to call you out on that.
So basically, what I thought was going to happen was everything that happened, like them going into the cemetery, graveyard, whatever, and then doing everything they did. But I thought they were going to go somewhere. I don't know how, like leave that little pouch behind or leave the exact amount of change. I don't know how, like either on the grave or somewhere like in a gravekeeper, like in a little... Usually at a grave or usually at a cemetery, there's like some kind of...
like an offering box or something.
Dude, that's true. I didn't even think about that. I was just thinking there's a graveyard or a cemetery. That's true. It's attached to a church typically, or a near a church. They could have found that. But if not, I was just thinking they would have like put it in front of a door. Cause usually, I don't know about the early in the Americas, but from what I have read, from what I understand, maybe not every cemetery, but typically cemeteries had keepers. They had someone who would live there or stay there to, not to guard, but just to kind of like a caretaker. And that person lived on the grounds or near the grounds. And I just thought they would like take the amount and then just like leave it by the door. I don't know. But they didn't do that, right? They didn't leave anything.
If they did, it was off page.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. So I was a little surprised, like, oh, so not only did they like get more than a pound busking, which is pretty darn good. They could totally afford to, obviously they need the money, but they could totally afford to pay for the for Gavin's burial. But of course, it was too dark. They didn't want to wait. I get it. I get all the reasons. I was just a little bit surprised that they didn't leave something behind. More than the body. More than Gavin.
They did. They left Gavin. And they may have intended to leave something behind, but they did get a little waylaid at the end. There were some unexpected developments.
Oh, That's true. It wasn't as smooth an ending as they had planned. So they drive the wagon to the cemetery or the graveyard, whichever, and it was extremely dark. This theme, or this, you know, her describing it, I don't even know if it's a theme, is like all throughout the chapter. It is always dark, always dark. Mostly always dark. Later on, it gets a little more light.
I'm like, at the end, it's not real dark.
Actually, that's funny too. I didn't think about the different timing of the chapter. The first half of the chapter, all the way up through after they bury Gavin and they're leaving, is extremely dark. So you could definitely say, you know, that's symbolic as well. So they drive the wagon to the cemetery. And as I said, it was extremely dark. And of course, Claire thinks of the Tannisk, or at least it comes up, the thought. She's like, yeah. They decide to bury Gavin near the wall of the cemetery. Jamie jokes that while the priest wouldn't bury him for free, he likely won't trouble to dig him up for nothing. So they're probably safe. As long as they can get in and get out without being caught, they're safe.
Now, did I read correctly that they're burying him in another grave?
Oh, no, they dug it.
But was it a solo grave, or did they bury him on top of another grave? Did I misread that or misunderstand that? Because they kept saying that it sounded like I may have totally heard the wrong thing, but I don't know. Her continually calling themselves feeling like a grave robber made me think that even though they weren't planning on taking anything, that they were depositing things. But
I remember the grave robber comment. They may have been near a grave, but they weren't burying him with or on top of anybody.
Okay, good.
So young Ian finds a spot. And everyone's a little bit freaked out because of the dark and the location. So, like, again, there's this theme. Like, everyone's freaked out and it's really, really dark. In case you forget, Dinah tells you a few times.
I bet they're all thinking of that Tannisk story, yeah. To be honest. It was really poor timing to tell that story.
Yeah, exactly.
Right before they all start doing that in the graveyard.
Jamie has conveniently taken a bit of the candle from the tavern they were in. And they use that to light a torch to see by. Diana has Claire looking up at the stars, which reminds me a little bit about, I think it was in the beginning of Voyager. I could be wrong. The prologue with the puddle?
That was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not just like, oh, she feared puddles, blah, blah, blah. There was that thing during the prologue or during that puddle prologue that mentioned stars. And it was something along the lines of, yes, she was afraid of falling through the puddle, but there was a thought or a hope maybe that if she stepped into them and fell, that the stars that were being reflected in them were stars that she could hold on to and they would save her from like, you know, going further down or something like that. And I know we made a remark, I believe it was us, could have been someone else, I think at the beginning of Voyager, that because Jamie, at least in the books, is over and over and over compared with the sun. And what is the sun but a star? So Jamie is the thing that literally saves her, anchors her, etc., as she falls through time. Jamie likens the moment to attending Easter Vigil at Notre Dame in Paris. He describes... Huh?
He said, what a... He's like, it's a cool place I've been. I mean, it's one thing to be like, it's like going to church on a Sunday, but it's like very name specific. Like, yeah, it's like, it's like going to Easter Sigil at the Notre Dame Cathedral. And
the church was dark, he recalls. People could purchase small tapers from old ladies, old crones, Diana writes, who were at the doors. And it was very dark because the church is, of course, very tall. And there's a lot of empty space because people are not that tall. There's a lot of air above you, if you will. So it's very dark above you, but it was packed with people below, quote, in anticipation of an imminent resurrection. And so if you don't know what the Easter Vigil is, it's the night before Easter Sunday. And in liturgical churches, the vigil or the night before to hold vigil for something is also the eve, right? So Easter Eve, Easter Vigil, and the big, literally like the 3 hour long church service. It's one of the most beautiful services of the year, besides like midnight by candlelight, like midnight services for Christmas or something. It's gorgeous. I could not even imagine it in Notre Dame. That would be a dream to see. But so the night before Easter, of course, Easter celebrates the resurrection of Christ. That's what Christians believe who celebrate. And that's why I quoted this quote, in anticipation of an imminent resurrection. So that is why they're there. Then he describes it further. Out of the darkness at the vigil, the priest had called Lumen Christi, and the candles one by one are lit, and light is spread from person to person, and that is done to this day.
Well, that's ironic that he tells that story, and then they have their own imminent resurrection.
Yeah, exactly. Duh, exactly. And he says Lumen Christi to everyone, but to Gavin, and then he says, "Rest in peace, friend." So Claire is going to hold the torch as the men take turns digging. Now, Claire makes a... When I read this, I thought, oh my gosh, did I like never catch this before? Or at least in the listening. Claire makes a titi oopsie. She says, observing as the men are digging, quote, medical students used to pay men to steal fresh bodies from churchyards, unquote. And Jamie says, did they or do they? I don't know if I ever caught that. So when I listened to Davina, I was like, oh, snap. And yeah, apparently it's not her first foible. I know it's not her last, but yeah, that's all I can say. I can't get too far ahead. I'm thinking like two books ahead. I can't do that. So it's a wonder, though, that no one else noticed it. Although actually probably not, because they kind of are one track minded. They're like scared poopless. Don't want
to. They just want to bury the body and get out. They're like, can we not with the conversation? Let's just dig the hole. Put it in it and get out of here.
Exactly. And leave. Cindy R. writes, Ian didn't pick up on Claire's slip referencing the past. That is actually current day. Perhaps he chalks these slips up to what makes Auntie, quote unquote, special. Remembering that many thought her a white lady or even a fairy during her early years with the family. I wonder what stories were told about her while she was gone. That's another book too. Lallybroch for the 20 years. Well, I guess after Jamie goes off to Ardsmuir. So even during that time, Lallybroch for the 20 years Claire was gone. That's a good story too.
I wouldn't say that would be another book two. That would be another book three because it would be concurrent
summer
with the third book.
Dorcas.
Yep.
Young Ian relates a similar story of when his father was incarcerated at Edinburgh's Tolbooth Prison, how one of their cellmates had consumption or tuberculosis. And after he died, the man with consumption, not his father, a doctor from the hospital, and two others had come to take the body to the dissecting room, but they grabbed Ian Sr. instead. And all parties were pretty freaked out. So they all feel a little wonky, but Jamie lets them know that he's, quote, not afraid of wee ghoulies, unquote. And he and Claire share a wave of lust. Only the first.
I know. Before you go there, that's a funny statement. He's not afraid of wee ghoulies. I remember when I lived in the South, I was visiting some friends in West Virginia. I think it was West Virginia. And they were like, let's all go to this haunted abandoned house. And I was like, okay, let's go. And so we drive to this place. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. We pull off. It's this like abandoned, like old farmhousey thing.
You already lost me at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I know. It was
it can't be out.
I know, but it was super late and super quiet. And then and we kind of walked out. We didn't make it past. There's no front door, okay? So it's just a gaping hole where the front door would be. So we walked up onto the porch and we're standing there and I'm like looking in. You could see that there's like, looks, it's very dark, but you could just kind of in the dark make out that there was kind of a doorway that looked like it led down to a basement on the left-hand side. And then in the front, there was sort of like a couple of steps up into the main area, but like the floor just didn't look really solid. And we were just kind of quietly listening. And it sounded like, first of all, you could tell that there was like livestock someplace in this house. So like it sounded like kind of like sleeping chickens. And I don't know how to fully explain that, but where they just kind of make little like soft chicken noises, like softly. And then what sounded like whispering, but like not like ghostly whispering, like live people whispering coming from the basement area. And I was like, y'all, let's get out of here. I'm like, I'm not afraid of ghosts, but I'm certainly afraid of like live people coming up the stairs and like killing us. So I was like, and that's what scared me, because I was like, if that had been some sort of an eerie ghostly experience, I would have been like all into it. But the fact that it literally sounded like there was actually live people like hiding out in the basement, I was out, done.
Remember, Diana tells us that we make our own ghosts. So absolutely, that would freak me out more than someone's tale of something.
Yeah. I was like, nope, those are live people. Those are not dead people. And they are hiding in that basement and we are getting out of here.
So we're reminded over and over. And when I took these notes, I was taking it at this point in the chapter because that's when I thought about them and that's when it made the most sense. But truly, thinking ahead to the end of the chapter, it is another theme that is going throughout this chapter, at least. We're reminded over and over of their mortality. So Gavin's dead. The men are sweating. So Gavin's dead. So that's like life death. The men are sweating. That's a sign of effort, exertion, being very much alive. Claire and Jamie share the lust wave. That's another sign of being very much alive, right? And Ian has them laughing while he tells the story of Ian Sr., another sign of life. They're, even if it's nervous laughter, they're still capable of having a somewhat light moment. It's like maybe not quite gallows humor, but it's the same idea, right? It's laughter to get you through difficult moments. And Claire, of course, had cracked her tibia only a few months prior. So while she definitely was not necessarily close to death in that, it shows, you know, how her going overboard could have killed her. The tibia, no, could have made her lame maybe, but it wouldn't have necessarily killed her unless it had been a compound fracture and come through the skin, which it did not. But yeah, so all of these things like literal life and death issues or things that very much alive humans are doing, which again, like almost reaffirms life in some way. And of course, there's lots of tie-in with the prologue here too, as we watch our characters be freaked out in the cemetery. Claire mentioning the Tanisk and Jamie mentioning the ghoulies. She also has a flash of, quote, tumbling in the dark to a fierce, blind coupling amid crushed grass and raw earth. Unquote. Did you get that?
How she wanted to have sex with him in the graveyard?
No. Oh, maybe.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was the lust thing. Okay. Yeah, I thought about it too. And then I had a shiver run up my spine. And he had a hard on.
No. Summer.
You don't remember that?
I don't mean. Did you? Summer, yes, I remember that. But when she said that, I didn't have. And it's the same theme, right? The whole thing Diana said Jamie talked about in book one, how fighting gives you a raging cock stance, yeah. Asthmatic, right? So this whole thing with life and death and lust, like they're all kind of, again, that's life affirming. If you survive a battle and you have a cock stand, that's freaking, what's more life affirming than you wanting to rut with someone? Come on. So, or at least a dude. So, and now we find out it's for healers as well, because she's felt it and she feels it now, but she has felt it before. So what I'm trying to say though, is when we had that, when she has a flash of I thought she had a memory and not just an idea, because my brain went straight to their final coupling before he sent her back through the stones at the end of Dragonfly and Amber. She was obviously, she could have died. You know, you never know, going through the stones. He was going off to die. So that had the same kind of life and death thing to it. So I thought it was a memory, but I think it's closer to that. The thing that I think leans it more toward imagining doing it right there is the whole thing about raw earth.
Yeah.
Crushed grass. I mean, grass can be anywhere, but the raw earth, they're digging up Earth. It's probably going to be raw. So yeah, I just wrote, would that have been at the stones just before Culloden? That's what I wrote.
You think it's going to be raw?
Summer, you're awful. And in case you forgot, which we didn't, Diana lets us know that yes, Rollo is still there. Jamie then goes to get Gavin, and Fergus reluctantly offers to help him. It's like, yeah, McDuke, excuse me. He never calls him McDuke. My lord, you know, would you like some help? You know, I know he's a, and Jamie's like, he was wee. I can handle him. And then young Ian's like, look, I'll join you too. And then the dudes are like flopping all over themselves, trying not to be left behind. Yet they're happy to leave Claire behind. Which is funny. Young Ian is wondering if the Tannisk would return for Gavin, specifically because now that Gavin, well, okay, he's dead. Gavin, at least in Scotland, once the whole Tannisk thing was done, he never left his house after dark until he went to go fight for Bonnie Prince Charlie. And we saw how that went, right? So, and of course, this is years later, 20 something years later. No, 22 or whatever years later, in the New World, he'd been sent to as an indentured servant, right? And I think if the Tannisk was going to get Gavin, it would have been before now. But I see what he's saying.
Do Tannisks cross the ocean?
You know, girl, now you are getting into American Gods territory.
Yeah.
According to American Gods theory, yes. They are maybe not as strong as they were in the homeland, but, and it doesn't have to be just like a god. It's not just someone you worship, right? At least in American Gods. It's the whole package of the belief system. But yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. In American Gods theory, which I think is, oh, if you guys haven't seen that show, oh my gosh, it's so freaking good. And the book is amazeballs, especially the 10th anniversary edition.
The audiobook version? Okay.
Yes.
It's
good. You listen to it too? Oh my God. And Neil himself, which is his Twitter name. I mean, Neil.
Neil Gaiman.
Thank you.
Neil Gaiman.
Mr. himself, Mr. himself is actually Jamie. So, I bring it back to Outlander all the time. No. Neil Gaiman, I mean, I do like his writing anyway, but oh, wow. Yeah. So if you have something that you're interested in and it's more of the fantasy, almost like fantasy horror, huh? A little bit. I don't know that the Tannisk would have followed, but the story is fresh in their mind. Gavin's actually dead and they're all freaked out because of the cemetery and it's dark. So I get it. So they make it back to the wagon and Duncan is still sitting with it, awake and keeping vigil. Crooning. And then, boom. Someone cries in Gaelic something about hell and God. Fergus yells, Sacred Virgin, in French. Everyone is shouting. The horses are freaking out. And Rollo is about to bite a bitch. Because he can't cut a bitch, so he would bite a bitch.
No, he's about to bite a smuggler.
Look, I'm going with the phrase. Claire screams, quote, a pale figure loomed out of the wagon bed, swaying with the wagon's jerking, unquote. Yeah, that would be enough for me to like get out of Dodge, except where do you go? Where do you go?
Yeah. I mean, you gotta hand it to Stephen Bonnet. He does know how to make an entrance.
I was just about to say, and an exit. You shut up, Summer. You're getting way ahead of us. Oh, gosh.
You shut up when you talk to me.
No, I mean, you stop getting ahead. I'm not going to take it out because it's funny. And it's not really a spoiler. It's not just
a spoiler. We've all read.
Not everybody who listens to this has read all the books.
They've all read this chapter. And he made a good exit from the hanging.
Now you're trying to save yourself. Okay.
You're the one. I'm not saving myself. That's what I meant. And that's what I said.
Not quick to judge. But when you say he makes a good exit, you know where my brain goes.
Well, that's not where my brain went.
So Rollo jumps at it. Jamie and Ian yell. The ghost screams. Fergus ran.
As one does.
Fergus ran back to the churchyard, crashing over tombstones in the dark. Now, let me tell you, I have not done that ever, and I hope to never do that. However, just going through, especially older cemeteries, in broad daylight, there's typically some kind of like order, like it's lined up, or not always, but a lot of times. And it can still be tricky and you're seeing everything. Can you imagine in the dark? oh my gosh.
And there is an old cemeteries. There's no rhyme or reason to how things are buried and what they don't all have. Like the more modern ones have a lot of maybe flat gravestones that are flat to the ground. Oh, yeah. But these things are all over the place. Some of them are probably like wooden and crosses, and some are big stones, and some are just depressions in the earth. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason to old school cemeteries.
Well, the danger is not just, I mean, the first danger is obviously hurting yourself. Like you get off easy if you just trip and fall on grass. You could trip and fall and like literally hit your head on the gravestone next door. I mean, it could literally kill you.
Right?
So
cause of death, graveyard.
Seriously, there's that danger. There's hurting yourself. And of course there is truly the danger of death, but also, what the heck? You're gonna if you are running away from something because you're like scared for your life, right, or something, you're shocked, whatever, and you are running into this area. There's not just the danger of hurting yourself physically or dying. There's also like, can you imagine your poor mind? I mean, I couldn't imagine. I would freak out. I mean, running is bad enough, but besides hurting myself, I would scare myself crapless if I tripped and then saw like this head. I don't even know. Your brain goes to the furthest places and, oh, dude, I just, yeah, not a fan. Among all of this kerfuffle, Jamie dropped the torch. Claire is trying to salvage it so they don't lose all the light. Fergus, who had run into the graveyard, returns with the spade. And he's commanding the ghost to stop. Then he steps forward and hits the ghost on the head with it. Then he threatens young Ian and Rollo. Jamie recognizes the knocked out man, not ghost, in front of them. It's the escaped prisoner who was to be hanged with Gavin. The man is described as, quote, young, about 30, muscular and powerfully built, unquote, with fair hair. And he had a faint Irish accent. I loved this. Quote, Rollo shoved his nose into the visitor's armpit, sniffed, then jerked back and sneezed explosively, unquote. The man had been with the wagon since mid-afternoon, because he starts talking now. And before that, he said he'd hidden under the gallows cart. And Diana/Claire remarked that his eyes were a pale green. The man's name is Stephen Bonnet. Claire describes him more. Quote, Bonnet was what country people called well set up, with a tall, powerful frame and a barrel chest, his features heavy boned but coarsely handsome, a few inches shorter than Jamie, unquote. And, quote, no stranger to a fight. He had a slight crookedness of his nose, unquote. And Claire also notes his animal magnetism. Now, Bonnet tells them he was condemned of smuggling and piracy. And he tells Jamie he only killed people who would have killed him first.
Seriously, could he have picked a better profession to tell Jamie that he was? I'm like, if any profession was going to get
a let go, yeah.
Yeah, like not even just profession, but maybe not even profession is not the right word. If any crime he's guilty of. Whatever that is, I mean, the only thing that could have made it less, that could have made him more appealing to Jamie is if he'd said, I was married to a time-traveling witch, or I was a printer of seditious materials.
Well, I lost my first child, and I went out and did XYZ in my grief.
Right.
I don't know. I'm trying to help.
I know.
Jamie tells him to go free. But Bonnet wants some help. He's like, actually, I can't go free yet. He asks them to help him get through the checkpoints. And he uses the name of Gavin Hayes to guilt Jamie into it.
You know, how long?
I mean, wouldn't you?
No, I would have. But what I'm thinking, though, is logistically, how long were they actually locked up together? I don't know that it's long enough to actually call yourself a friend of him.
Oh, yeah. Cindy has something to say about that, too.
I think he clearly knew that he knew Gavin because he had the body, right? So he knew that he was a friend of him. So all he was like, okay, well, I know his name. He may not have even known his name until that moment when they were all riding in the wagon together. He left me with smarmy feelings from the very first time he showed up on the screen. He's an opportunist. But he But he said that himself when he said he was a pirate and he sold whatever he could sell. So that should have been very clear that he was an opportunist from the moment they introduced him.
Jamie is about to make a decision, but he looks to Duncan and Duncan agrees, quote, for Gavin's sake, unquote. They get him to help. I mean, at the very least he could do was help them get the ding dong body buried. So he helps them. He says, yeah, you have to, but we have to bury Gavin first. Cindy R. writes, first impression of Stephen Bonnet. My spidey sense tingled. The description of his fists half closed in readiness and the crookedness of his nose and scar near his mouth indicating he was no stranger to fighting are what gave me the impression he was not one to be trusted. Diana's description of him having, quote, the musky smell of prolonged fear, unquote, just cements in my mind that this isn't his first rodeo with the law. I don't buy that he and Gavin Hayes were friends. Surely Jamie would have had an idea of this. It puzzles me that Jamie, so protective and with a good read on people, agrees to help Bonnet. Maybe he's worried that not helping him will cause Bonnet to seek revenge later. Maybe he truly is doing this as a last favor to Gavin. What do you think?
I mean, he clearly is. I think he has a soft spot for smugglers. I think he's just lost his friend Gavin, and on the off chance that it was a friend, he doesn't want to be the guy who purposefully, you know, leads him to his own demise. And I think this is something we should all remember.
They bury Gavin and set up a small grave marker, and they once more bless the grave. Jamie recites part of the Requiem Mass, eternal rest, grant unto him, O God, and let light perpetual shine upon him. And they leave behind them a candle. Diana writes, quote, like the sanctuary lamp in an empty church, unquote. So it wasn't until they got to the cemetery and were digging, right, prepping the grave, that Jamie, understandably, and they had the taper that he stole that they make into the torch. It wasn't until they did that Jamie mentioned the Easter Vigil in the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, right? And so you have this whole setting, like, again, Diana does this constantly, this helping of setting the scene by retelling or relating of a story or some event. And so at this place, even though it was freaky because it was dark, and of course there were, you know, death around, it was peaceful. And as they leave the grave, they are leaving what Diana seems to be alluding to is they are leaving a holy place and entering the wilderness once again. And again, this theme, the holy and the wilderness, the unknown, it goes into like the last page, the last line of this chapter. Cindy R. writes, I thought the time spent making a marker for Gavin and leaving a lit candle so he wouldn't be left in the dark, which was pointed out in chapter one, was so poignant. Such respect and care shown to his friend. Lord, I love Diana's Jamie. You know, it's so funny you say that, Diana's Jamie. I really like Diana's Jamie. And in case you guys didn't hear that, you can go back and listen to my discussion of episode 307. I'm sorry. It just made me laugh. Oh, I mean, I think everyone loves Diana's Jamie, and I love the show Jamie. It's just when the show Jamie like flips on a dime, when it gets confusing. They reach the checkpoint and there are 8 soldiers, more than the normal 2. And they were armed and alert. Jamie gives his name and says that they are going to Wilmington with family and servants, traveling by night because of the corpse. So he's like, da, da, da. Oh, and by the way, and I have a corpse. And the checkpoint soldiers were like,
he was reaching into the back of the wagon, right? As he said, oh, and there's a corpse back there.
Yeah, exactly. So Duncan and Fergus have been walking along the wagon here. I'm guessing before they actually get to the checkpoint, they dissolve into the woods. So that, basically, I mean, I know there's a reason for that. It's to make it safer for them. So they don't have to, you know, answer. They have fewer things to answer for. But it also gets them out of the way so we don't have to focus on them the rest of the chapter. And we can get to the nitty gritty stuff that we like. Jamie is straightforward about the corpse. It was a friend who was hanged. We have permission to take him to his family. Griswold, the lieutenant or the whoever's in charge confirms, sorry, not the one who's in charge, the one who has to go back and look. Griswold confirms that it's a body. And then he's commanded to use his bayonet to jab at him to make sure it's a dead one. Thankfully, Bonnet is good at Shavasana because that would have made me squeal or scream. Could you imagine? Do you think you have the wherewithal to withstand multiple leg stab wounds?
Just the one.
Oh, no, he did it like twice.
I only remember the one.
It was more than one.
Hey, at least he only stabbed him in the leg and not in the guts.
That's true.
But they even made mention to that. He's like, dude, he's already ripe. Can we not, like, you know, stab him in the gut and make it worse?
Yeah. And release. Oh, that's the worst place to stab a dead person. That's not involved.
I mean, is there ever a good place to stab a dead person?
Well, you shouldn't be stabbing a dead person. But if you have a fresh body, well, fresh doesn't really matter. Well, yeah, it does. If you have a body that has not been embalmed, you don't want to open up the belly sack. I'm telling you. Even a live person. So during all of this, young Ian is whistling a Gaelic tune whose title is In the Morn We Die. They are finally allowed to pass. They check in with Bonnet, who is wounded but says he will survive. He's not able to walk quite yet, but he tells Jamie where he can drop him off, where he can await his associates. All young Ian hears is pirates. Even though he doesn't say it, he knows Bonnet is a pirate and a smuggler. And when he hears associates, he thinks multiple pirates. Some more insight into Bonnet. The governors would call them pirates, but merchants would perhaps not. So you have maybe not insight into Bonnet, but he's definitely not. Yeah. Summer said it earlier, and I don't know that I used this word. I haven't used the word yet, and I don't think I wrote it down, but Bonnet is an opportunist. He seems, obviously he'll do anything for a buck, but he seems to be, he definitely is taking advantage. I'm not saying right now, but in the times where he has an item and then he's selling it, he doesn't care who or what he hurts as long as he gets the stuff to his customers and they pay well. And he kind of seems to me to have a similar attitude. Not that I've done a lot of interviews of these people, but his attitude is similar to what I believe I've heard of people who like sell drugs and all that kind of stuff. It's like, look, if they don't come to me, they're going to get it somewhere else. And as long as they pay for it, I'll hand it over. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't care what it is. It's not my thing. They're going to do it. So I'm just making a buck. I'm basically taking advantage of them kind of thing. Stephen Bonnet is impressed that Jamie isn't requesting a reward for saving him. And because when he asks that, are you expecting a reward? Jamie gets all, not quite butthurt, but almost butthurt. And he tells him, quote, I meant no offense to you, sir, unquote. So Jamie saves Bonnet's life, not just inadvertently by including him in the wagon on accident, but purposely by allowing him to travel with them. And then again, by dropping him off where he can await his friends. So that's like almost like three times, two times on purpose, one time on without knowing. Claire is exhausted and she falls asleep against Jamie's shoulder. She dreams of skunks under tavern tables and waking to join in a chorus of the Star Spangled Banner, then of a swinging corpse that raised its head to grin with empty eyes. That's the kind of freaky thing that would freak me out. That's a nightmare. She awakens to find Jamie shaking her. He has to get her in the back of the wagon to sleep so she doesn't fall off and like hurt herself on the ground. And she and Bonnet basically switch places. She goes and lies down next to young Ian. She awakens a little bit later to hear Jamie and Bonnet chatting. Why had Jamie saved him for his own sake? They have something in common. Their own hanging looming ahead of them. Jamie knew that feeling well. Quote, and yet I lived through the grace of one who risked much to save me, unquote. And we get more mention of ghosts. Bonnet names Jamie. Now, my Cherokee is really rusty, but something like Asjina Ajeli or Askina Ageli. I'm guessing it's Asjina Ajeli. Something like that. A Cherokee term for half ghost. A person should have died by right, but yet remains on the earth. That would be both Jamie and Claire, actually. So Diana only mentions this of Stephen and Jamie, but it's actually Claire, who has been ill, and Asjina Ajali, I need to go listen to Davina because she might at least butcher it less, is one who can talk to the spirits and see the little people, the Nanahi. Like fairies, like the old folk, Jamie confirms. Even a smuggler pirate like Bonnet has standards. Speaking of Highlanders, he says, quote, for a barbarian, I have found you to be passing civil, sir, unquote. Cindy R. writes, the discussion between Jamie and Bonnet of the Astina Ajali was interesting. Bonnet telling Jamie he is one because he escaped hanging. Jamie has had many instances of escaping death thus far. Not just that particular event. I think back to the weeks at the monastery during his recovery from Wentworth as one such example, how the spirit world was tapped into to recover his soul. Anyone else make this connection? Also, I find it curious that Claire does not have an internal monologue regarding this conversation. Of any present, she most surely represents a half-ghost with her travels through time, not to mention her near-death after Faith's delivery. Another thought, aren't all the travelers present somewhat representative of this? Fergus and Duncan have lost limbs and, from the time in which the story is set, could have easily perished from infection. Young Ian escaped death in the print shop fire. They have a bond that perhaps has not been overtly recognized, but is there nonetheless. They finally stop, getting ready to put Bonnet off at his spot. Claire decides to take a bath, and Bonnet takes his leave, saying he thinks people make their own luck. Which, interesting. Well, we shall see. Jamie says of Bonnet, quote, I have my doubts of the man. I must hope I've only been soft-hearted and not soft-headed by helping him, unquote. Jamie also says he could definitely leave him to hang. He says, quote, I shouldn't have liked to think I've helped a villain go free, unquote. Claire strips and bathes in the cool creek/river water, whatever it is, and when she's done, she climbs onto a rocky area, quote, and lay languid as a mermaid in the moonlight, unquote. Claire gets her Claire on. And as she's enjoying herself, Rollo's head breaks the surface of the water. He's been fishing.
Pets and children always interrupting things.
Yes, apparently so. And then she is alone again. She is totally Eve here, naked in Eden. Even thoughts of Bree were tolerable. Quote, I missed her greatly and thought of her constantly, but I knew she was safe in her own time, and that knowledge made her absence easier to bear, unquote. We learned that Jamie is barraged by bugs, but she is left alone. She thinks it might be due to the TT. Her being out of her time and thus more evolutionarily progressed wasn't tasty to the bugs and potentially protected her from colds, illnesses, etc. Quote, bloodthirsty bugs like microbes evolved very closely with humans and were sensitive to the subtle chemical signals in their hosts, unquote. She longs for Jamie. She's hot to trot for him. He startles her by appearing just as she's about to... dot, dot, dot. He had been standing in the stream up to his thighs, totally erect. Adam, but rough. A wild Adam. He goes to her and they enjoy each other. And then they talk about the heat and the bugs. They talk about America in her time and what it will be like. The people, the roads, the land that is conquered, if you will, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, to California. Today, in their time, they only had to worry about Indians and beasts. Okay, before I go any further, I have to ask a question. So how are we, you and I, Summer, for this read-along, going to refer to today what we would, whom people we would call Native Americans? Do we call them Native Americans or do we refer to them as they're referred to in the book? Now, it's not necessarily...
We're not calling them savages.
No, God, no. I didn't write that down. I wrote down Indians. But obviously today, they're not Indians. That's Indians from India.
Can we just call them natives?
I think that's all well and good. The problem is, it's not a spoiler to say there's a heck of a lot of involvement with the natives, Native Americans. And there are different...
Well, once they give us a specific tribe, we refer to them by the tribe.
That will be a lot easier. So Claire tells Jamie that the Indians, the Native Americans, will be defeated and driven back, and many killed. Jamie thinks That's good. But Claire mentions that it's actually not so great. She likens their struggle to his own, someone trying to push him off his land. And he identifies with them, to a point, he says. He would kill someone trying to take away his land. But he says he would stop there. He wouldn't then scalp them or eat their privates. Now, they agree they won't get tired of each other because they're talking. They wonder, you know, after all these years, after da-da-da-da. Well, he says, I think he starts like, look, I will never tire of being with you physically. And Jamie says, for example, he didn't know women pleasured themselves. And we find out what Claire tastes like. Quote, trout, fresh and sweet with a bit of salt. Unquote.
You know what? He is winning no boyfriend awards with that description.
Uh-huh.
I think he could do better. Nobody needs that level of honesty.
And then Diana confirms the Eden bit. Quote, I feel like Eve. Actually, I think she said that. Cindy R. writes, Diana truly knows how to weave her story well. In the midst of the tragedy of Gavin's hanging and burial and meeting the sketchy Mr. Bonnet, she throws in some vroom vroom. The quick exchange between Claire and Jamie in the graveyard, how quickly their passion for each other can flare. Damn, he says, and I agree 100%. As Claire bathes in the river, I'm right there with her, washing away the grime of the descriptions of sights and smells encountered thus far. Anyone else literally feel like you need to cleanse yourself after reading some of Diana's descriptions? The heat, the smells. They were...
The trout.
Oh, Lord. The salt.
Salty trout.
I know. There were times in the past two chapters where I felt where I feel gray. How does Diana do that? I feel this bathing is somewhat cathartic for Claire, not just physically, but mentally as well, leaving behind all they've gone through thus far, looking forward to establishing a real home in the wilderness of the new world. That's not just road grime she's scrubbing away with the riverbed sand. The dragonfly on the rock, quote, no more than a transparent shadow, unquote. My thought on this is that it alludes to Claire and Jamie's life together. They are still in their elemental form, but now have to add color, substance to fill in the transparency. The romantic interlude by the river, wow, just wow, makes me want to go seek out my husband. Really don't need to spend time detailing the obvious here. The fulfillment they achieve with each other never ceases to amaze me. It's what keeps me coming back for more.
And that was chapter 2. And that ends part 1. Join us next week when we move into part 2 entitled Past Imperfect with chapter 3 entitled The Minister's Cat.
Again, if you guys would like to join our community, we have an active Facebook community. You can find us at outlanderpod.com/group. And if you'd like to become a contributor to a future episode, to a chapter of our read-along, you can find out about how to do that by going to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/outlanderpod and look at the DOA, the Drums of Autumn read-along event under the events tab. Thank you as always so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.